So, yes, I offered to do things at the centre, and Samachitta corralled me into doing this. And I can't remember how it arose, but the debate arose between us as to what I should do or talk about. And I said that she said something like, well, whatever you're interested in. And I said, I don't mind. If people want to talk about it, we're very polite, and so on. And I said that one topic that was really interesting me at the moment was karma. And she said, as it happened, a number of people had questions about karma. So I've been given four sets of questions, two of which are, well, groups of questions about karma. So I'll concentrate on that because it forms one sort of overall topic. And if I've got time, I'll deal as fully as I can with the other questions when the time comes. But I'll start by talking about karma. It's been on my mind, I suppose, because I had a very vivid experience of my own karma. I'm not going to make precise at the moment what I mean by that. But the year before last, I spent 8 months in retreat. And a lot of that time I was completely alone. For about 5 months I was completely alone. And what happens if you spend time on your own, as many of you will know, if you've experienced any length of time on your own, you become vividly aware of what's going on in your own mind. Because, well, I live in Wales, so there are sheep about, but their interest is fairly soon exhausted, except for the terrible tragedy that's to come at the end of the summer. But, you know, the hills are beautiful, but, you know, they can't distract you for very long. In the end, you're just left with what's going on inside you. And what I became aware of was that all the time thoughts were arising in my mind and images were coming into my mind. For instance, I remember spending one memorable meditation reconstructing a James Bond film I'd seen 30 years before and which I hadn't enjoyed at the time. But the image came into my mind fixed onto it, and over it I went. Fortunately, after some time, this did die away. But what I became aware of was that everything I'd given attention to in my whole life, everything I'd done, in my whole life, had an opportunity to come back. There was nothing outside to prevent it. So it just sort of reemerged. You think, why am I thinking about that? It was coming up in accordance with a sort of underlying dynamic, which is at least substantially to do with karma. So I became very, very strongly aware that the mind that I'd taken into my retreat was the mind that I'd created in the previous 60 years of my life. And that under the law of karma, my mind was re-emerging, or mental activity was emerging, independence on what I'd put in there in the past. So I've of course been a faithful Buddhist for many years and believed in karma and worked in accordance with karma, but became much more strongly conscious of the crucial importance of karma. And I've been thinking more and more that we need to pay more attention to karma as a principle, especially because karma—it is karma, the law of karma—that governs the spiritual practice. If there was no karma, then when you sit down to meditate, anything could happen. You might do the mindfulness of breathing, and you end up in heaven or in hell. I know that does happen too, but there would be no sort of principle behind it. Anything could happen at any time. So the whole Buddhist spiritual life is governed by the principle of karma. So we need to be clear about it. we need to define our own relationship with it and, well, in a way, act in accordance with it. So I want to explore fairly fully what that means, because I've been asked a number of searching questions which really go to the heart of what is karma. Well, that's the first question. What is karma? No less than that. So what you could say is that karma addresses the question of what moral principle governs human life. And the Buddha was faced by this question, of course, 2,500 years ago, and there were a range of answers, alternative answers, available at that time. Most of them, that the predominant view of what governs life, involved some power or powers bigger than humanity. So a god or gods controlled human happiness, unhappiness, human fortune, misfortune. So it was believed, and it's still believed in India today, by many, many people, that it's the propitiation of these powers that governs your life. If you're on good terms with the gods or the god, then you'll have a good life. And, you know, in the case of the traditions within which most of us have been brought up or been influenced by, you know, God's made clear what he wants of us, a crude version of it, let's say, and, you know, our lives are going to be successful or unsuccessful, and our afterlife is going to be painful or pleasant, in accordance with the extent to which we adjust our lives to God's will. So at the crudest level, it involves, in India today, you know, making offerings to this god or that god. If you want to pass an exam, you offer incense to Saraswati. If you want a child, then you go to certain gods, there's certain temples you go to. So even though that's a rather crude version of it, it's kind of illustrates one aspect, one range of possible answers about what it is that governs human fortune or misfortune. So that we're subject to higher powers, which we must essentially learn what they want and keep them happy, and then we'll be all right. Again, putting it rather crudely. The other range of answers, at the time of the Buddha too, and which are probably rather common today, are pretty much that there's not much you can do about it. It's really a matter of chance whether you prosper or reach disaster. It's not within your power. Nothing much you can do. So you could say that these are the extremes of the alternatives about the principles, the mechanisms which govern human happiness and unhappiness, human fortune and misfortune. Is it some power greater than us that we must adjust ourselves to, or is it simply a matter of chance and, you know, you have to just accept the luck of the draw, so to speak? So the Buddha said that it's neither of these. There is, of course, a sense in which we are subject to chance, and I'll go into that in a moment. But there's a vitally important sense in which we have immediate control over our own, at least inner happiness and unhappiness. And this is the principle of karma. So the principle of karma is not the principle that governs all our experience. This is very, very important to grasp. It's not that everything that happens to us is the result of our karma, at least in the most immediate sense. Otherwise you get absurdities. You know, you have a plane crash where 300 people die and you cannot, with any degree of reason say that, it was all of their karmas that brought about that accident. That is just too ridiculous. The accidents happen to the good, the bad, and the ugly. So the principle of karma is not about everything that happens to you. So, I need to take a further step back. The point about karma is that it tells us the way in which our happiness and unhappiness are governed. It tells us the mechanisms which produce our inner happiness and unhappiness, our inner well-being and inner fortune. So this is the principle of karma, is an aspect of the larger principle praticca samuppada. Familiar with this? Of conditioned co-production. Put very simply, the Buddha said that the universe has regularities. It is ordered. It is niyamata. It functions according to order. And it's that order which science investigates. So there's, the Buddha said, there's an order which governs inorganic matter, the law of gravity. My science is not very great, so it's the regularities that can be discerned which determine, you know, how a stone falls, even to some extent what constitutes matter. It's the laws of physics, the laws of chemistry. So the Buddha didn't, of course, use the term physics and chemistry, but what he said was that there are laws, there's regularities that govern inorganic matter. Then there are laws that govern organic matter, the laws of biology, the laws of botany, and so on. So there are regularities in the way that an organism works. Then there are regularities which govern the mind as instinct. You know, animal psychology, you could say. For instance, I saw in my last visit to India, somebody brought along a cobra to a retreat. Sort of thing that happens in India. He was... we're sort of demonstrating the way this cobra worked, so to speak. And, it was a king cobra with a proper hood and all the rest of it. I didn't actually much like him. He was sort of playing with it. I didn't like that very much. But what I was really impressed by was that he clearly knew the way the cobra worked. He knew that the mind of the cobra, you could say. And he was able to reliably work with that so that... You know, for instance, he was sort of keeping the cobra distracted by moving both his hands. So the cobra just sort of froze. It didn't know which way to move. And at one point he was distracting it. He just leaned forward, took it behind the head and lifted it up. I just sort of realized that deadly cobra, of course, just functions according to instincts, which, you know, he... good Mitra that he was, he understood the laws that governed that cobra's functioning, its instincts. At one point he picked it up by the tail and held it up, and it just reared up with its hood up. Very impressive, although, as I say, I just don't like animals being played with in that way. But it illustrates my point. There's a regularity is, I suppose, discernible in instinct. That's the best way of talking about it. So, these regularities which can be discovered by scientific investigation. I don't call them laws, or rather I call them laws only after calling them regularities, because the language of law suggests a lawmaker, if you see what I mean. But law in the scientific sense simply means... discernible regularities, that the universe operates in according to regularity. You can discern that regularity through empirical investigation, and you can make predictions in dependence upon it, because the universe is ordered. it has a sort of grainy understructure which determines how it functions. So this is very interesting. The Buddha gave a fundamental view of things which was not at all in contradiction to the empirical methods of modern science. It's quite important. Got no conflict with scientific discovery, properly understood. So yes, those are the laws that govern matter, inorganic matter. Those are the laws that govern organisms. Those are the laws that govern instinctual mental patterns. But what about human moral action? So the Buddha said there are regularities here too. That the universe, you could say, has fundamental moral principles built into it. And that is what the law of karma, as we usually call it, the karma niyama, is really about. It's about the regularities in the universe that are structured into things. They're not arbitrary. They're not devised by humanity. They're part of the way things are. If you do this, then certain consequences will come. If you act, the law of karma says, with a skillful mind, that is a mind that's based on maitri, metta, on what comes next? Generosity, selflessness, and on mindfulness, then internally there will be a sense of satisfaction, of pleasure, of well-being. And the more you act in that way, the greater and greater will be that sense. Now you can't, and vice versa. You know, if you act with greed, then you will get a sort of unpleasant, a distaste. There will be a bad taste in your mouth, in your mental mouth. If you act with hatred, yes, there will be an unpleasant sort of aftertaste, which will leave its trace in your mind. If you act ignorantly, stupidly, without fully clarifying things, that will leave a trace in your mind, which will be painful to you. It's very obvious with anger, isn't it? You can even feel very righteous about your anger, but still, you don't feel good. It doesn't feel good. And a state of intense longing, which is an extreme of craving, is very, very painful, and so on. So the Buddha said that the regularity works at the moral level in these ways, that actions that are performed on the basis of skillful states of mind, what he defined as skillful states of mind, or they're really more sort of helpful states of mind, or yes, rather than harmful, harmless states of mind, they lead to a pleasurable inner experience, directly or indirectly. It's not quite that simple, but broadly speaking, let's put it like that, and vice versa. So karma is the Buddha's defining of the regularities that run through our moral life, and that show how that moral life leads to a pleasant, fulfilled, or an unpleasant, painful mind. And it's that that I experience so vividly on my solitary retreat. All my unskillful actions, all my skillful actions, sort of flowering in my mind. I could see them all. It shaped my mind. So that the law of karma at its most basic is the law that governs the way in which our actions affect our own minds. Of course they affect others, and that then comes back at us. But it gets much more complex when you enter that wider field. And the law of karma, traditionally speaking, also can determine what comes back at you personally in concrete terms. Certain events may occur to you because of things that have happened in the past, things that you've done in the past. But that's very difficult to work out, very difficult to see. You know, did that person come and shout at you as a result of your karma? Or was it just, you know, if you like, chance? But the main thing we do know, the Buddha taught us, and that we can verify in our own experience, is that skillful states of mind bring a more fulfilled mental experience. Unskillful states of mind drag the mind down, to put it that way. This is the very simple basis for the law of karma. It's the law that governs the regularity of things as regards our moral life. Moral life in the Buddhist context means those actions that we perform deliberately, intentionally. Karma is even a modern Hindi word which just means action. It's a Sanskrit word. The Pali word that the Buddha would probably have used is kamma. It's a version of the same word. And it means that which is done. Kar is the root verb, which is to do. So karma is that which is done. But it has the connotation of that which is deliberately done. So, you know, if my glasses fall off my nose, well, I haven't done it. You could say I haven't fixed them on properly, but, you know, if they fall on the floor and break, it's not an action of mine. It's my neglect in not fixing them properly on my head. But if I... I'm now performing karmas. I'm deliberately speaking to you. I'm trying to say what I want to say. So I'm performing a karma. There's a deliberate action that's taking place. I hope that you're deliberately listening to me. Listening is also an action, as you're probably well aware. It costs some effort sometimes. So a karma is intentional action. It's not involuntary action. It's not... you know, you've got the shakes and you knock a glass over or whatever, or you're very, very tired and you stumble. Those actions where you form in your mind an intention of doing something. So that is what karma is. And actions performed on that basis have a consequence internally. They have a consequence externally, of course. But that consequence may come back at you because you modify the world around you, and that modification of the world around you may sort of feed back to you. So you could say the law of karma could be conceived as a feedback system or law of feedback. Much more complex. But yes, you could look at it in that way. What you do modifies the world, which then comes back at you. Not necessarily in a direct way. It may come back at you indirectly. Oh dear, it's all the usual thing, isn't it? One sets out to find an example and might go blank. But, you may get upset or angry in a shop or something like that. But it doesn't necessarily come immediately back to you. But... somehow or other, and the Buddha says that it's sometimes not possible to see the mechanisms, it comes back at you. In some way, you have to get paid back. Internally, there'll definitely be a modification. So, that's what karma is. And maybe I should just pause and check that what I've said so far is intelligible. It probably raises far more questions than it answers, but... let's just see if there's any feedback, if my karma is going to come back at me. Stunned silence, or silence of clarity, or Yes.
Hello, sweetie. I'm Melanie. I just wanted to clarify a bit about intention.
Ah.
Because I'm wondering to what extent is there unconscious intention?
Yeah, yeah.
Does that make sense? So we don't know that our intention is unskillful, but that's how we do it. That's how we've been conditioned to do it. So I wonder whether you could still call that intention, even if you're not aware of it, you have it.
I think that what one would have to say is that probably, in a sense, no motivations are ever entirely unconscious if they are intentions, if you see what I mean. So that there is a motivation there which it's as if you do not allow yourself to know fully your own intention. And you can sometimes see that. You realise that in a certain sense you did know, but you sort of didn't allow yourself to know. So without getting into the complexities of psychology, I would say that from a Buddhist point of view, even what we would usually refer to as unconscious intentions were kind of peripherally conscious intentions, but where there was, in addition, a sort of an intention not to know that you intended. And sometimes you can catch yourself at that. You sort of look back and you say, actually, I did know what I was doing. Of course, that the human mind is capable of extraordinary complexity, and with a culture, a very complex culture such as ours, these matters become extremely difficult and very tangled. And you may need quite a bit of help to disentangle what your intentions were. But still, from a strict Buddhist point of view, there will be a consequence to that even peripheral intentionality. Again, I've thought about this, a certain amount myself, because one of the things I realised in looking back on my life, it's a bit like death. You're just sort of nothing there to mute yourself with. You're just left with yourself in a solitary retreat like that. And you sort of realise, yes, actually I did know what I was doing there. I just didn't sort of want to acknowledge to myself. The mind is extremely complex, and of course we can, because of upbringing and so forth, can get very difficult to fully recognise. I think there is probably a point at which you cease to be responsible, and but I'm not really thought enough about it to say when that would be. But that's the way I would deal with that question. And I think in some ways it's quite useful to realise that. Otherwise, I think we use the notion of unconscious intentionality to allow ourselves off the moral hook. And I think it's quite important to take responsibility even for intentionality that is obscured from you by yourself and by your own conditioning.
I'm also wondering about your example of your glasses.
Yeah.
Because it seems to me that quite a lot of things happen in life through a kind of carelessness. And
yes.
And some of the worst things can happen.
Yeah. Well, from a Buddhist point of view, that unmindfulness is an unskillful motivation, or it has karmic consequence. So, basically it's greed, hatred and delusion. And delusion here, it means not necessarily being confused, it means not really allowing yourself fully to know. So, a failure to be fully mindful, as you say, is itself karmic. It has a consequence. A very, very vivid example of that. No, I won't go into that now. It's slightly different, but I think it's quite important. No, I will go into it because it relates back to the same question. It's part of the same issue. That one deliberately fails to recognise one's own motivation. That's the point. That even unmindfulness is sort of deliberate. It's not easy to say that because it doesn't sort of appear like that. But in a certain sense, you deliberately mask things from yourself. And of course, you learn to do that because part of the effect of karma is is habit. Karma forms habits in the mind, so that, well, it's a well-known case. If you hit somebody once, you know, for instance, in domestic violence, you know, it's well known that it's usually men that hit their wives once, then they do it again. After that, it's almost impossible to stop. They really need help to stop, because you've sort of dug a channel in the mind that means that action easily follows. So karma partly has a shaping effect on the mind. I usually give the example of rain, because I spend time in India in the monsoon and I live in Wales. but you know, when rain falls on flat ground, it begins to sort of dig a channel. And you know, to begin with, it's just a tiny little indentation. But the more rain falls, the deeper the indentation gets, until eventually you have a formed rivulet or whatever. In India, you see this so clearly when the monsoon comes. It's just got a flat field, and after a while, you've got rivers, you know, which are several feet deep. So the mind is like that. Your actions. Karma isn't just about the effect that you experience, it's about the way you form your mind. So it's about habit. So unmindfulness, a failure to see what's happening, is a habit. You don't let yourself see. So I was going to illustrate this, I'm not completely sure whether this quite does it, by an example a cousin of mine gave me, who was a BBC reporter, and he interviewed Albert Speer, who was Hitler's architect, if you remember. He told the story of... he talked to Albert Speer in Spandau, and he's apparently a very, very thoughtful man by that stage. He had a long solitary retreat, poor guy, 40 years or something like that. And my cousin said that he was a very interesting and reflective man by that stage. But he asked him, was there a point when you sort of bought into the Nazi system? He said he knew precisely when it was. He said that you know, Hitler patronised him as an architect. He created the Nuremberg rally and so forth and so on. And after the Night of the Long Knives, if you remember, when there was a putsch against one faction of the Nazi party, he was promoted to be Minister of Propaganda, I think it was. No, it wasn't, but Minister of something or other. And he said he walked into his office, he was taken into his office on the first day after the Night of the Long Knives, and he saw something on the floor. He saw a patch on the floor. And he said, in a flash, he knew what it was. It was the blood of his predecessor. And at the same time, he knew he was not going to recognise it. So he, in a flash, knew it, and in a flash decided not to take cognizance of it. He said in his solitude in Spandau jail, he became aware that was the moment when he compromised, when he allowed ignorance to determine his actions, if you like. He overcame his humanity at that point. He was extraordinarily reflective, but that's what ignorance is. It's not merely a failure to notice. It's not being given the information. It's refusing to see, because it's in your interests not to see. It's very difficult to catch that, but it has a consequence, and it shapes the mind, as it shaped Albert Speer's destiny from then on. He participated in the whole fiasco. And it's very, very interesting just to notice the way in which your mind sees and won't see, because it suits you not to see. You know, it's why terrible things are done in nations. People just refuse to see what's going on. You just accept it, and it's not in your interest to say something about it, so you ignore it. How did you know, in many, many totalitarian states, well, Britain too, awful things have happened, and well, we turn our minds away. So that's what ignorance is. I think that rather sharply and gruesomely and powerfully illustrates what ignorance is, and I think it's a strong factor, and we become habituated to it for complex reasons, some of which go right back into childhood, some of which are obviously to do with you know, our upbringing, our socialization, and so forth. But yes, Buddhism defines the three principal unskillful categories of motivation as greed, that is, the fixation upon certain objects, things, ideas, people, especially because we believe that they will complete our happiness, or the fixation upon people, things, ideas, because we believe that their elimination will complete our happiness, and ignorance, which is the refusal to acknowledge the reality of the situation because it suits us. It keeps us comfortable, we think. So these are motivated, and they have necessarily karmic consequences.
That's the first question, isn't it?
Yeah. What is karma? Yeah. Yes.
25 to 9.
Oh my goodness. Well done. Yes. Am I being deliberately ignorant? Does it suit me just to go rambling on? We've got a captive audience. Do thoughts have karmic consequences? Well, yes, they can do. But in a way, perhaps the way in which I presented things makes that fairly obvious, that that the mind is constantly modifying the future, and modifying, if you like, its own future. Of course, there isn't such a thing as the mind. The mind is, it's only a sort of term for a sequence of processes. But those processes determine the processes that follow on from them. So the thoughts are powers. They affect the future. So I find that quite interesting. I don't know whether you experience this. Sometimes you sort of just find unaccountably you're in a slightly dismal mood, say. And what I sort of trained myself when I catch that to try to see, well, what made that happen? And usually I can see, there's a sort of sequence of thought there which I didn't make fully conscious and that left its trace in my mind. And it's like the weather, the English weather. It leaves a sort of, a gloomy cloud in the mind. Or it can be that you feel unaccountably quite cheerful and happy. And you can sort of see, it was that thought that, you know, somebody's going to give me a box of chocolates or something like that. So you can see the way in which the thoughts have a power to modify the mind. It's also said that thoughts can modify the world around us. Buddhism thinks of thought as a force outside you. I think probably that the illustration that most of you may have some familiarity with is with metta. I don't know whether you've ever experienced this. You have a good old enemy, and you do metta bhavana to them, and you actually succeed in wishing them well. And blow me down, the next time you see them, they're really cheerful and pleased to see you. I've had that happen to me so often. So clearly something is going on which isn't to do with, matter. It's to do with the power of interaction of thought. But again, our experience is quite powerfully on solitary retreat. I actually resolved a couple of difficulties in relationship just by doing metta on them. When I came out, met people, the situation was different. I also picked up quite a lot of thoughts towards me. Some of them not very nice ones, but I was conscious of the way people were thinking of me. So, you believe me or not, but this is the traditional Buddhist belief that thought is a power, is a force. It certainly shapes your own experience. That's why we do meditation, because you're learning to develop skillful thoughts And that will change the way you feel. And I hope that everybody's had an experience of that, of sitting for 20 minutes, half an hour, 40 minutes, developing Maitri, and you feel a lot happier. So yes, thought is a karma, has a karmic consequence. Can a group of people or a country have a collective karma? Well, strictly speaking, no. Karma is individual. So you could only speak of a collective karma in the sense of an aggregated karma, if you see what I mean. It's the sum total of all the karmas. But, you know, who would be the agent of that karma? I was astonished to read that after Hurricane Katrina in Florida, that a survey found that 60% of Americans believed that the hurricane could have been an act of God, God's punishment for America not being on the right path. I must say, I felt a bit worried at that point. So that means that those people in St. Louis who were very good and did the Metta Bhavana every day, they got washed away just as much as those who didn't. So it makes a mockery of what karma is. Of course, you know, the sum total of the actions that we perform has a very strong effect on the environment that we live in. But you cannot speak properly of collective karma in the sense that there's a sort of single consequence to some sort of collective entity. Because from a Buddhist point of view, karma is individual. Although, as I say, of course, the actions that we all perform have a sort of aggregated effect. Is karma a raft or a truth in itself? Interesting. Yes, what's been got at here?
Would it help you to know the person posing the question?
Ah, this is Alison.
Yes, over there.
Some people say that karma doesn't exist in itself.
Is to get
people to behave more skillfully.
Ah, oh, a mechanism of social control or moral control. I think that some of the ways in which it's talked about in Buddhist tradition, as much as any other, do amount to that. I mean, you get the equivalent of hellfire preaching in some schools of Buddhism, and I personally regard that as usually quite unskillful. You're frightening people. Although, in a sense, there is something to be worried about. Yes, that is not karma, properly speaking. But karma, properly speaking, as the moral regularity, the regularity of moral action and its consequence, is a truth. It's the way things are. That's what the Buddha taught. But it can be abused. It can be even abused for social control. I've seen that in Burma. The junta argued that demonstrating against them was karmically unskillful, and they got the official church to justify that. But that's what happens, isn't it? That social power. Organisations take over moral and religious teachings and use them to their own ends. It's happened to every religion. Christianity, we know most powerfully. But no, in itself, it's definitely considered by in Buddhism as a truth. It's an aspect of the fundamental truth of conditionality. It's conditionality as discerned in moral action and its consequences. Yeah, does that? So in a sense, you could say it can't be left behind. Although in an interesting way, it is left behind. Because the Buddha is said not to have any karma. He doesn't generate karma. Whoopsie. Anyway, okay, I've gone too far. So you could say that karma is the law that, or the principle that states the relationship between willed action and its experienced effect. Willed action implies a self-conscious individual. So once you become self-conscious, karma comes into play, because you can form an idea of yourself as an agent and of yourself acting. So as soon as you become aware of yourself as an agent, karma comes into play. But of course, that idea of yourself as an agent, in a sense, is a delusion, ultimately speaking, because there is no Atman, there is no separate self. So a point arrives in one's spiritual growth, a long, long way off, when you transcend that separation in your experience. And so then action becomes, well, a moga siddhi, unobstructed success. There's no willing, in the sense of no... A will is a hiatus in your experience. It's, in a sense, a conflict. You have to stand back from your experience and decide that you will do this rather than that. But in the case of a Buddha, his actions are, according to tradition, entirely spontaneous. It's immediately clear to him, if you could put it that way, what to do, and he just does it. So that's what I believe what a moga siddhi means. So the Buddha's actions are said to be akiriya, without consequence. You get in the Dhammapada, who can track him, that trackless one? So he leaves no trace behind. You could say that he's completely in tune with reality. So his actions don't disturb the harmony, the balance of things. He slips between the cracks of things. Whereas for us, there's a sort of... there's a break, there's a split between us and the other. And we have to decide how to act in relation to that. Skillful action brings us more into harmony with the way things are. Unskillful action alienates us further. The more alienated we are, the more rough and painful, spiky our experience will be. The more in tune with things we are, the more smooth, the more harmonious, the more flowing things will be. So yes, it's intrinsic to the way things are. This is the Buddha's teaching, and I hope that what I've said makes it clear just how important it is to us as people trying to practice the Dhamma. It's because of karma, this regularity, that we can practice the Dhamma. If there was no karma, you couldn't follow a path, because anything could happen from anything else, or you just wouldn't be obeying the right authority. How do we know which actions have karmic consequences and which don't? But in a way, you don't need to bother too much about that. But broadly speaking, you can say that all actions have some underlying intention, and that underlying intention, you won't say inevitably, but may contribute to the consequence, the vipaka, the fruit. Not all actions are effective. It depends upon a whole range of different factors, which I won't go into now. The sort of calculus the Abhidhamma gives of why some things are effective and others not. But in a way, don't worry about which have effect or not. Just try to act skillfully. And try that. Even one of the most important skillful actions you can perform is the acknowledgement of your unskillful actions. The more you can acknowledge them, the more you can pass beyond their karmic effect. Again, this is something I really saw sitting there in solitude, that there are certain painful consequences to my past actions. If I just acknowledge, badly done. I regret that. And the more fully I could acknowledge it, the more it was released, the more I was released from it. So these are the important things, not to work out what has a consequence and what doesn't. It'll all, as a broad sort of, everything you do, it aggregated, amounts to a karmic effect, if you see what I mean. It's more like that than that this action caused that. I sometimes give the analogy of a rope, which is made up of lots and lots of small strands of sisal, but woven all together. It makes a total sort of rope going in a particular direction. So all your actions, are part of a general direction, which is the shaping of your mind and the shaping of your experience. So yes, don't worry about it. Does the idea of karma predate Buddhism? Could he, Subhuti, comment on the use of the term in other religions? I'm certainly not well studied in this matter, but it did predate the Buddha. That's for sure. There's a very good book by Gombrich called Buddhist Beginnings, which goes into this and shows how the Buddha was trying to give new meaning to old ideas, and how karma was his principal sort of assertion of a new idea, but it was based upon previous ideas. In Hinduism, which is the alternative usage of karma that I'm most familiar with, you'll find two or three strongly contrasted factors. The first is that karma is ascribed to a permanent, unchanging soul or self, Atman. So the something in you that, as it were, undergoes the karmic process, which remains unchanged. And that, of course, Buddhism flatly denied right from the start. The second is that, in some forms of Hinduism, it seems to be said that, and this is quite common in modern understandings of karma, the sort of spirituality world, that everything that happens to you is the result of your karma. So that every mosquito that bites you is the result of your naughty thoughts, and so on. A comforting thought, or a discomforting thought. And this Buddhism flatly denies, and I hope the way I presented it makes it quite clear that the other niyamas, the other regularities, also deliver experience, and are the major means of delivery experience for us. And then the third factor, which is quite important, of course, for us in our connection with Dr. Ambedkar and his work, in traditional Hinduism, karma is said to determine caste. So your status is determined by your previous actions. So if you're born an untouchable, it's because you were very bad in the past. And what you have to do now, do your caste duty, then you might get a better rebirth. It's, I suppose, the nearest you come to it. I remember a hymn we used to sing. The rich man in his castle, the poor man at his gate, he made them high and lowly and ordered their estate. Amazing. It's the social appropriation of spiritual teaching. But in Hinduism, that's intrinsic. It's part of the system itself. Those are the three principal ideas that you find even in modern understandings of karma. Well, there's a famous one. What's that football bloke?
Oh, Hoddle. Glenn Hoddle.
Glenn Hoddle, wasn't it? He got sacked because he'd said that people who are disabled, it was their karma. Poor fellow. He was just giving voice to a widely held understanding of karma in the sort of spirituality world. I think it's very interesting. A lot of these ideas have been absorbed by kind of what I think of as very late decayed Protestantism, but that's another question. It's Luther gone mad, the priesthood of all believers. And people take on these sort of ideas which are half digested, which seem to you know, believe that everything is governed by karma. That is not the Buddhist teaching. And you'll find it in some Tibetan teachings, or at least some followers of Tibetan Buddhism tend to talk like this. But it's very much not the Buddhist teaching. And it's, you know, made sharper for us by our association with people coming from you know, that caste system, which is supported by the idea of karma. And, you know, you cannot believe that. So that's probably enough on that for the time being. But the Buddha certainly did find the idea already, but he gave it a much more comprehensive meaning, and its meaning is found within the context of his overall teaching of conditionality. And that's very important to keep in mind. It's only one aspect of conditionality, but it's the most pertinent for us, because it's the one where we have direct control and where we shape our own destiny. And I think that's something that if you are seriously interested in you know, following a spiritual life, you really need to think about and sort of see your own relationship to, and realise that, of course, on some levels you don't believe it. What you'll find is that there are corners of your mind that do believe still that if you walk on the cracks in the pavement, you'll have a bad day and so forth, to use a crude example. But all sorts of strange, I find that, little strange beliefs that if I do this, then everything will work out okay. The mind is like that. And or just, you know, perhaps I'll get away with it. You know, in other words, if nobody notices. And so on. So it's worth sort of examining your own decisions to see to what extent they are based upon a real conviction about karma. And I think that if you're you know, investigating the Buddha Dhamma, and you believe that you might want to take this more seriously, this is one of the things that you need to examine your own relationship to. Are you convinced? Of course, you can be convinced down to there. It's much more difficult to get convinced all the way down. But at least it's good to start by being convinced intellectually and in that sort of way, and then work it down into yourself. The Buddha has said that if you do not believe in karma, you're not really a human being. And you can see why. Because in a sense, you're not taking proper responsibility for yourself. You're living a life of instinct and of very narrow, selfish convenience. So more on karma. How am I doing?
Not great.
I'm very unconscious of time. How is the idea of karma and rebirth connected? God, blimey, how long have I got? karma... well, the next question, what about in this life? Well, yes, karma is operating now. I hope that in thinking about karma and engaging with the idea of karma, there's been some sort of modification of your experience now. And that, you know, by engaging with that idea in a sort of an intentional way, I hope you're feeling a bit sort of more awake and aware. So it should be operating now, you know. Otherwise, why bother with the metta-bhava and the mindfulness of breathing? Otherwise, they have no effect. So karma very much operates in this life, but it's also said to govern the processes of rebirth or rebecoming, so that the general sort of quality of that stream of consciousness that you build up in this life is the basis for the arising of a new stream of consciousness in the next life. I think it's very interesting. We use these words like mind and consciousness, and we cannot but think of a single static thing. But actually, that's just a substantive for a whole set of processes which are constantly changing. So these processes are governed to some extent by the law of karma in this life, and that same principle just passes on into another life. So the sort of general quality of the stream of vijnana, the vijnana shrota, then sort of re-arises in a new life. And the way in which the being unfolds is partly determined by a pre-existing stream of consciousness, to be as careful as I can about it. So that's how the idea of karma and of rebirth are connected. But they're not exactly the same thing, if you see what I mean. Karma is the more all-inclusive phenomenon, and rebirth is one of the factors within that. There's this continuing stream of intentionality, of experience, which is constantly modified within this lifetime, within the parameters of the physical body. But in a new life, in a new arising, it takes on the impetus from the previous life. Very, very interesting. Again, in this solitary retreat, I just became aware of something sort of the back of my mind that I couldn't altogether sort of see where it came from. Not, you know, I don't expect to see where everything came from, even in this life, because, you know, my first 1 or 2 or 3 years, I'm probably unable to be fully aware of that. But I just became more and more a sense that there's something coming from somewhere deeper. The conclusion I came to was that I'd probably been in the Second World War. It's quite likely. And that I'd probably killed. And that had some sort of trace in my mind. And I must say, once I sort of took that thought on, things changed a bit. So, you know, the act of killing another human being, even in what as near to a just war as you can have, still is a breaking of human solidarity and will leave a trace in your mind, which will continue. So, a little personal, speculative experience, if you like. Do you believe that skillfulness in this life has consequences in the now? Well, it's clear that I do. Otherwise, I wouldn't bother to meditate. Equally, I believe that unskillfulness in this life has consequences now. And I've seen it. I've seen it in my own unskillful actions and the way in which they affect me and the trace they leave in me. And I've seen it in other people. I've seen it in friends. I've seen people go down and down and down as a result of unskillful action. Almost to the point at which, you know, it's very difficult to reverse it. I used to work in that sort of world. Do you believe that leading an unskillful existence in one life will have consequences in the next rebirth, and can it cause illness, disability, etc.? I know some people who believe it can. Well, the Buddha said it can, but one shouldn't go then to say that all disability or disadvantage in this life is the consequence of unskillful action in the past. It may be a matter of chance, if you see what I mean. It's just the genetic material that's available to you. I remember talking to Bhante about this because, you know, in the sequence of the Dalai Lamas, you get the great fifth and then the pretty mediocre sixth and the regularly awful seventh or whatever it was. In fact, there's one who was fairly clearly mentally deficient and died, you know, when he was quite young. So I was sort of saying to him, you know, that disproves the whole thing. And Bhante's response was, well, it may do, but it may be that was the genetic material available, if you see what I mean. That was the best you could do in the circumstances. Well, it's just provocative, let's say more than that. I don't know whether it's true or not. But you see what I mean? It's not that there's a new birth waiting just for you. you know, circumstances arise and, you know, certain, you know, man and woman are there and that's it. And then to some extent what you've done in the past will then help to shape that. I won't go to that. I've done a lot of thinking about this, so that's why I can't be organised properly.
There was another set of questions. I don't think.
Yeah, yeah. On karma.
Yes. So, from Meg Hughes, although she isn't here, so you've done the first two, and then this.
Oh, okay. No, I didn't see that. I would like to know the Buddhist take on where the life force that inhabits a new becoming comes from. Life force is, presumably the term, it comes from a Sanskrit and Pali word, jiva, the jiva. And it's a kind of, a sort of loose term for the impetus that leads to a new life. But it's said that the new life arises with a certain sort of force and vigour, which is determined by the previous life. It can be modified in this life, but you're sort of dealt a particular hand. So it's said that the length of life is to some extent determined by the jiva. So some people have you can feel it, they've got a lot of life force, and they under normal circumstances would live a long and healthy life. And some people seem to, not have much and sicken and die quite early. So that's the traditional teaching, although one must never with these things argue from effects to cause, if you see what I mean. It's fair enough to say that the cause may bring that effect, but you cannot say the effect is always determined by that cause. But yes, the jiva is the sort of the momentum which you start with in the life, and which can be strengthened and can be weakened, partly by mental factors, partly by physical factors, and which determines how long you live. So you remember that the Buddha traditionally could have lived to the end of the kalpa, it's said, but he had to be asked, and poor Ananda didn't take the hint. So the Buddha died at the relatively young age of 89 or whatever it was. Whereas he could have lived out a much longer lifespan, because enlightenment liberates the life force, if you see what I mean. It takes all restriction from the life force, so that the body in which enlightenment is gained then has the force to live out a full life. That's what lies behind that, whatever you like to make of it. So I don't know, does that satisfy you? Questioner? Oh, she's not here. Oh, well, then she's definitely satisfied.
I'll convey that.
Yes. So where the life force that inhabits a new becoming comes from. So it's that sort of momentum that comes from the previous life. It's a bit like waking up in the morning. There's that delightful gap of who am I and where am I and what's going on. I like staying in that, not quite knowing which bed I'm in and where I am. And you just sort of delightful kind of blank space. And then you who you are, why you're there, what you're doing, what's irritating you, what's exciting you, comes back. So it's as if on a much larger scale there's that sort of hiatus. Do you see what I mean? It's an illustration only. The question went on. Not the process by which a new becoming comes about, but where the energy comes from that animates a pattern of atoms into a living being. Well, yes, I think that's it. It's the vijnana shrota, the stream coming from the past. It's a momentum that kind of patterns the genetic material, you could say. And what happens to that energy when a being dies? Well, yes, it's said that there's some continuity of conscious experience that passes beyond the physical death. The Tibetans explored this very fully. You'll find this in the Tibetan Book of the Dead. But other traditions have also gone into it. It's said that you remain conscious for a certain amount of time. And of course, it's a very confusing and bewildering experience, because you can see yourself, but you don't know you're dead sometimes. And one of the things that somebody guiding a dead person needs to do is to sort of say, well, you're dead. But yes, what then happens is that it's as if the momentum begs a body, if you see what I mean. It can't be sort of sustained without one. Again, you can get some of experience of this in ordinary life. You know, if you get the sack, or you know, you lose your job, to begin with, you feel, oh, great, you know, freedom, I can do anything. But then a sort of itch develops. You really want a kind of identity. You want to, have a sort of meaning and purpose. Again, I experienced it very, very strongly on solitary retreat. My mind constantly seeking rebirth. You know, I'm going to be this, I'm going to do that when I grow up. it's as if the in our immature, in our ignorant state, we cannot rest easy unless we've got an identity. And so that longing for an identity survives. And it's that longing for an identity that then connects with the genetic material and provides a primary patterning for it. And that's why the you remember, the Bodhisattva holds to nothing whatever. He's supported by nothing. So the Bodhisattva, or the Buddha more particularly, is content without an identity. Consciousness requires no construction. You don't need to think of yourself as something. In a way, the whole Buddhist life is a progressive letting go of identities, so that you're more and more happy just to be aware and just to respond to the needs of the world. But that longing for embodiment is intrinsic to our the flow of the mind. It's the primary need of the mind. It's to find an identity. It's satkaya drishti, the desire for a conscious identity. It's atma drishti, atma sneha, the longing for a being, an identity. It's quite interesting to examine it. You see it on all sorts of levels. If you walk into a gathering where nobody knows you, you sort of try to seek an identity. You try to seek a way for people to see you, a way for it to be seen. So a lot of it's a very strong, very deep motivation within us to be somebody. And there's the famous saying, isn't there? Being nobody, going nowhere. So when you reach that state where you're quite happy, there's no clinging, no attachment to an identity at all, well, that's the highest happiness. And that's when you can live life most successfully and most constructively, creatively for yourself and others. So it's that longing that is the primary element that passes into a new life. In the Yogacara system, they say there are two perfumings. There's the perfuming of the grasping onto a self, and that's the primary patterning which structures the new identity. And then there's the perfuming that comes from your past actions of body, speech and mind that creates the sort of the pattern through which that identity expresses itself. Yes, so the questioner says, Meg says, I don't know where to look for ideas on this. Well, look to the Buddhist tradition. There's a lot to be said. For instance, looking at the Book of the Dead would be a good place to start. Looking at, for instance, I think Bhante's Three Jewels is a very, very good account of karma and the way in which karma functions in forming a new life. There are many, many sources of that kind. But I do think this is all extremely important, that we know it and understand it. What's the timing?
9:15.
What do you want to do?
Wow.
I've got two more questions.
What do people want to do? Shall we carry on?
Yes.
Not completely sure.
Another 15 minutes?
Well, let me just deal very quickly with the two remaining questions and finish, just to do justice to people's asking. This is from Claire Barton. given that a relaxed mind is a creative mind, cannot WBO continue the creativity and make inroads to a calming approach within schools, personal social aspects of the curriculum? I'm afraid I don't know the reference, so difficult to comment. Perhaps on a trial basis of 6 months in each and a coordinated start, focusing on one school within the North, South, East and West regions. The West Midlands aiming to teach children and staff meditation so its intrinsic beauty can be experienced if only for 10 minutes of each day. Well, I think that, I mean, I don't quite understand some of the background to this, but I think there is probably a unique opportunity at the present moment to bring meditation into schools, from what I've heard and read. I believe that the new schools curriculum requires quite a strong, multicultural input. And I know that the Sheffield Centre, they've started a business teaching Buddhism and meditation in schools and school visits. So I think we should take advantage of that sort of opportunity. Partly it just puts us in contact with a wider range of people, and hopefully, yes, it will have some positive influence on some people. So, yeah, I support the general intention behind the question. I do think that we should take many, many more opportunities to get the Dhamma into into culture in general. In a way, this way, talking about relaxation is in a certain sense, you could say it's not really Dharma. It's taking aspects of Buddhist practice and using them in a very soft way. But fair enough, that's a start. But I generally would like to see Buddhism much more part of the public debate. I think we've got important things to say about a lot of major issues in the modern situation. And our voice is not heard. And that's our fault, our karmic consequence. Right, next one, a little bit more complex. This is from Yvonne. That Yvonne. Both you and Banti have made comments in the past regarding women, which seem to be judgmental generalisations. I would love to see the FWBO moving from a culture of categorising, labelling of groups of people to one of mutuality and respect for the individual apart from their gender or also religious disposition, which is more in line with a 21st century consciousness. Yes. So Sangharakshita has made comments about what it's like for men and women to undertake the spiritual life, and said that to some extent women in general are at something of a disadvantage in relation to men. Although you cannot say anything about any particular woman, as it were, from that generalisation. Personally, and I made the mistake of trying to explain what he meant. for which I am still suffering. The conclusion I've come to is that I really couldn't care less one way or the other, if you see what I mean. Because in the end, if people are going to develop, they're going to develop. So I think that whether it's true or not, it may be true, it may not be true, it doesn't really matter very much. The main point is that everybody should be encouraged to undertake spiritual life. So that's the background. It's an old contention within the movement. But Bhante's made it quite clear that he doesn't regard it as something that people have to believe or accept or even like. It's not, as it were, essential to the practice of the Dhamma. It's an observation that he believes is generally true in the most qualified sort of way. But I really think it's probably time just to forget about it. And I regret having myself my logical sort of way try to explain it. I think it just made more of a very minor issue than was really warranted. But yes, the question goes on. I would love to see the FWBO moving from a culture of categorising, labelling of groups of people to one of mutuality and respect for the individual apart from their gender or also religious disposition. Well, I'd really have to have a jolly long talk with Yvonne, or continue a jolly long talk with Yvonne, to work out whether there was a culture of categorising and labelling. By the way, labelling is a label. So, yes, I'm not myself convinced that there is a culture of categorising and labelling. Although, obviously, when we ever have any discussions, we use labels, we use generalisations. But yes, it doesn't seem to me to be the principal flavour of things. Respect for the individual apart from their gender or also religious disposition. Yes, again, it's a difficult question because there are quite a lot of buried assumptions which we'd need to really sort of discuss to get down into. But I suppose the question about respect for the individual apart from their gender or also religious disposition. Well, personally, I do think we should have respect for the individual apart from their gender or religious disposition. And I hope that that's the principal flavour of the movement, the respect for individuals. That's what I would certainly hope, and I would hope that's my own practice. Religious disposition, perhaps here what the issue is, you can have respect for an individual without accepting their position. You may disagree with somebody whilst respecting them, if you see what I mean, respecting them as an individual and having well-wishing towards them. And, well, to be a Buddhist is not to be a not-Buddhist, if you see what I mean. To be a Buddhist, for instance, is not to use the language of God. You may feel affinity with people in certain respects. A very interesting discussion with Bhante yesterday, in which he was saying that he saw most religions, or aspects of most religions, as belonging to what he calls the higher evolution. So that he believes that all, the best aspects of all major religions are to do with the growth of the individual and the development of a higher life, even a higher realization. But he believes that, from his point of view, Buddhism is the one, the Dhamma is the one that most clearly and adequately expresses the truth of things, and that other religions have part of that and partly distort it for very clear reasons. Buddhism has a quite distinct analysis of thinking which can be applied to other religious systems. So if we are Buddhists, then we're not Buddhists. And that doesn't mean that we can't respect people, that we can't honour them as individuals. My brother is a Roman Catholic priest. We get on very, very well. We cooperated really well on matters that were important to us. We even agree on a lot of major sort of moral and political issues, for instance. But yes, I don't believe that salvation comes through Christ. I don't believe that I need the salvific power of the church to bring me salvation. I don't think that respecting my brother as an individual requires me to accept his point of view. So I think that something of the complexity comes up there, that it's possible to disagree whilst not disrespecting. Well, there's a famous saying by Goethe, isn't there, that to tolerate is to disrespect. What he meant by toleration here is to sort of rather woolly kind of, oh, we all believe the same thing, it's okay. In a way, you're not taking somebody seriously then. To disagree with somebody is to take the ideas that they have seriously. And it does not necessarily involve disrespecting them as an individual. And yes, I thought the idea of a 21st century consciousness, Yvonne and I are able to respect each other while disagreeing quite a bit on these sort of issues. But 21st century consciousness, to me, it's far from clear that that is one of mutual respect for the individual. I've just come from Hungary, where 30% of the population voted for extreme fascist movement, which is anti-Gypsy. I've come from India, where a majority of people still hold beliefs in a caste system which leaves many deprived. We're involved, Britain is involved in a war in Afghanistan, which is to some extent to do with religious beliefs. A friend of a friend was killed the day before yesterday in a bomb blast in Pune, which was motivated by religious beliefs. I'm afraid I don't believe that 21st century consciousness is a progression. I don't believe in that sort of interpretation of history. I don't believe that history is an inevitable march of progress, even though there are patterns of progress, and there is, fortunately, there are many people of goodwill. I think that the same old forces of greed, hatred and delusion are still amongst us, and I think they're more dangerous than they've ever been, because of the crowded nature of the world and its interrelatedness and the power of modern technology. I think we're in a more dangerous situation than ever. So, yes, I'm sorry, Yvonne, I don't...
Yeah, I'm just sitting here feeling very frustrated.
I'm sure you are, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you put the question and I had to answer it.
Well, I suppose maybe it's the form we're meeting in, which isn't serving...
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You'd like a discussion. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, anyway, I understand. I thought you would feel a bit frustrated, but you asked the question and I felt obliged to answer it. But yes, I think we should be careful not... If maybe this isn't what you meant, but I want to make the point anyway, that I think to disagree and to have definite opinions or views is not necessarily to be disrespectful not to have metta. And I think that one of the virtues of Buddhism for me is its clarity. And I think we do need to assert a quite different perspective on the world. A 21st century consciousness definitely needs that Buddhist perspective. So I'm sorry, Yvonne, but maybe you need another opportunity.
Yeah, I think for me it's a prime example of how one interprets a phrase. Or
yeah.
You can pick out things and make an argument, but it's not the whole story.
I'm sure, yeah. But unfortunately, I'm presented with a written-out question, and I have to answer it.
Okay.
I could have ignored it, but I felt injustice to you. I should try to answer it. I knew I wouldn't satisfy you. So we'll continue the discussion. But I did want to make a few points, even if they're not the points that you intended. Well, first of all, I think that let's just not bother about the relative attitudes of men and women and just get on with our own spiritual life. I think just forget about it. And I regret myself having taken the issue up, whether or not it's true. Let that be shown by events. Yes, I do think there is a need to disagree. And to show that Buddhism does have a different perspective. And yes, I do think that the world is in a very, very dangerous state and that we need to contribute to resolving it with other people of goodwill, whether we agree with them fundamentally or not, or ultimately or not. So a slightly difficult note to end on, but probably where we have to end.